Today's internet is an engine of innovation, creativity, free speech, and democratic participation. Applications like email, the web, and voice over IP have changed the ways we communicate. Companies like Amazon, Google, and eBay point towards new ways of doing business that are fast becoming integral to people's daily lives. The combined effect has undermined established pre-internet businesses, from retail stores to publishers to telephone companies. These interests have taken their case to the Federal Communications Commission, the courts, and now to the U.S. Congress. I'm David Eisenberg. Over the next hour, we will hear four voices from Freedom to Connect explain the forces that are now colliding in a battle for the future of the internet.
What the telephone companies are essentially proposing is a two-lane internet, and they're going to have a fast lane. Their own content will go in that fast lane. Everybody else is going to be relegated to the slow lane.
So I want to talk to you about Google and our Wi-Fi stuff. There's obviously at one end the net neutrality themes, and on the other hand, there's just what can we do to get more access to more people cheaply and more accessible?
You know, I was one of the early public officials who stood up and talked about net neutrality. I called it net freedoms at the time and still subscribe to it wholeheartedly. But I'm also a student of Washington and regulatory process, and I'm worried for what's going on.
The government ought to create a public thoroughfare to the internet by regulation. It is in that space that democracy in the United States will be defined.
You're listening to Four Voices from Freedom to Connect. I'm David Eisenberg, a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. I co-produced a conference with Pulver.com in April 2006 in Washington, D.C. We called it Freedom to Connect. Our goal in producing it was to start a new discussion, one that reframes connecting to the internet as a constitutional right, like freedom of speech and freedom of the press. In this hour, we will hear four voices from our conference, a congressman, an innovator, and two former heads of the FCC, explain the forces that are now colliding in a battle for the future of the internet. The House Subcommittee on Telecommunications and the Internet is a focal point for new laws affecting the internet. Congressman Rick Boucher is a member of that subcommittee. Here he explains four hotly contested principles that could become cornerstones of future internet law.
The Federal Communications Commission under Chairman Michael Pell issued a set of network neutrality principles. These were principles only. They never were reduced to a formal rulemaking at the FCC. And what I mean by that is that they were never given the force of law. In part, I think, in large part, because I believe the FCC was concerned that it did not have adequate statutory authority to adopt these network neutrality principles. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia has kept the FCC on a very short leash when it comes to the question of the adequacy of its statutory authorities. There are many cases going back over a period of 15 years or so where the D.C. Circuit has invalidated FCC orders on the ground that the FCC didn't have the authority to issue those. And so the FCC in this case, I think sensing some statutory inadequacy here, decided not to go forward and turn these principles into a rulemaking. So today, they are only principles. They do not have the force of law. These principles are fine as far as they go, but they don't go far enough. Here are the four principles. First of all, that consumers may access any content over the internet. Read literally, what this would mean is that a transport provider who has market power in the last mile, you read that as a cable company or a telephone company offering either DSL or cable modem service, may not block access to websites that its customers may decide to access, nor may it limit the content on those websites that its customers are receiving. Now, all of this is subject to the ability to guard against spam and to operate the network in a manner that assures that it is secure. But with those exceptions, the broadband provider may not block access to content nor discriminate against content. The second principle is that the consumer may run applications of his or her choice using the network in order to do that. That means you can download whatever software you want to and utilize that software. Now, all of these, by the way, are also subject to the limitation that, you know, what you're downloading has to be lawful content. I mean, there are some permissible controls that can be put in place for unlawful content. The third principle is that you can connect devices to the network. Whatever device you want to use that does not harm the network, you are able to connect. And the fourth principle is that every consumer is entitled to competition among network providers, service and application providers, and content providers. And so the broadband provider that connects that customer to the internet can't operate the internet in such a way so as to limit that competition. Now, these are broadly stated principles. We have not actually seen applications of these principles beyond one case, and that one case was the Madison River case that you may be familiar with, where Madison River, a small telephone company, sought to block the Vonage port, to prohibit voice over internet protocol delivered by Vonage from being accessed by the small telephone company's customers. This was about as blatant an action as one can imagine in violation of the most basic network neutrality principle. That case went to the FCC. Now, because these principles did not have the force of law, the FCC did not have the authority to enter a direct order without the consent of all of the parties to the proceeding. But Madison River, I think, sensing weakness in its position, agreed to the entry of a consent order at the FCC that said that it would not block the port in the future. Now, what that basically says in terms of precedent is not very much, because it was a consent decree. The FCC did not have full legal authority to order Madison River to stop that. And so even in this most obvious instance, the FCC, under current law, is kind of powerless to act unless it can persuade the bad actor to adopt a different course, which it was able to do in that case. So obviously, we need to do some things to address network neutrality just in terms of these four principles, which I think we all would agree are a pretty good start, although not clearly not enough. What the bill that is before us will do is essentially say that the FCC may enforce these four principles. It gives the FCC statutory authority to have what we call a complaint process. And that means that if we had another Madison River case or some other factual circumstance where one of these principles or some number of them were violated, the aggrieved party could come to the FCC and file a complaint. And the FCC would have the authority under this bill to issue orders. So it could do as a matter of law what it had to do as a matter of persuasion in the Madison River case. Now, that's a step forward. There is no authority for a rulemaking, however, so the commission could not elaborate on these principles. The commission could only take the principles as originally announced under Chairman Powell, and then enforce them when a complaint is received. They can't expand on them by issuing a rule. The big problem here is that at the time Chairman Powell was at the FCC, and up until very recently, we were not aware of what now is obviously going to be a major new business model. And that new business model is the announced plan by some of the large telephone companies to derive another revenue stream using the internet and their dominance within the last mile in order to do it. And that new revenue stream is going to be charging edge providers, content providers like Google or Yahoo or Microsoft when it offers its applications and services, a fee. And that fee will entitle that edge provider, that content provider out on the internet to get fast lane treatment, high speed access delivered over the broadband pipe into the home. Everybody else is going to wind up getting regular speed into the home. And so what the telephone companies are essentially proposing is a two-lane internet that goes into the home over their last mile pipe. And they're going to have a fast lane. Their own content will go in that fast lane. And also in that fast lane will be the content of any content provider who pays for the privilege of getting fast lane access. Everybody else is going to be relegated to the slow lane. Now, what's the major problem with this? Here's the major problem, as I see it, and maybe you can suggest some other major problems too. But the major one I see is that there could be a dramatic adverse effect on innovation. It wasn't very long ago that Google was in a garage getting started, and today there are Google wannabes in a garage somewhere getting started. And how is that Google wannabe that's in a garage getting started today going to be able to pay every last mile provider in the country a fee to get into every potential customer's home? The answer is obviously they can't. These are companies that have to give their services away for a long time in order to become established, and they're simply not going to be able to pay this toll in order to have fast lane access on the internet. And in the slow lane, they're not going to be able to compete. Latency matters in these instances. And a lot of consumers are simply not going to be interested in waiting to access a service in the slow lane when they've got the established Google or Yahoo there in the fast lane coming to them with lightning speed. And so the effect on innovation could be real. Admittedly, it's something of an unknowable. We're talking about the future here. We don't know how this will work in practice, but I have deep concerns that it will work to the disadvantage of young innovators in this country. It may be harder for them to acquire capital to start up. They may be sufficiently discouraged that they'll do something else rather than start an internet business that could grow into the next Yahoo or Google. So it's a major problem. Some would say, I mean, when I've raised these arguments, some of the response that comes from the telephone companies is, well, I mean, once you get by their superficial arguments, they then say, well, let's just wait and see how the market develops. Let's see how this all works out. Here's the problem. We don't have an opportunity. We don't have the luxury to sit back and wait and see how all of this works out. Experience teaches us that once revenue is being derived by a business from a particular business model, it is virtually impossible to outlaw the business model. You simply can't come back and do that years later. If telephone companies 5 years from now are deriving billions of dollars in revenues from this toll gate apparatus they've put in place and charging internet providers, service and application providers fees to get into that fast lane, and we see that innovation is dampened and we can measure that effect and actually make the case with real numbers instead of hypothetical arguments, which is what we're having to do now, it's going to be too late to act. We're not going to be able at that point to take away a business from which the telephone companies are deriving billions in revenues. I know that as certainly as I stand here. This is the critical debate that we're having in telecom legislation this year. It is this net neutrality principle.
You're listening to Four Voices from Freedom to Connect, the Internet Freedom Conference. Listening to Four Voices from Freedom to Connect, the Internet Freedom Conference. I'm David Eisenberg, the conference co-producer. We just heard Congressman Rick Boucher discuss the FCC's four Internet principles: freedom to access content, freedom to run applications, freedom to attach devices, and freedom to access reliable service plan information. Congressman Boucher says that these four principles are a good starting point for the next telecom law, but not nearly enough. We heard him say that an internet toll road could inhibit the next generation of Google wannabes. Now we hear from Chris Sacca, one of Google's main business development leaders. He tells the Google story, beginning when Google itself was a Google wannabe.
I don't necessarily single-handedly handle all the acquisitions, business deals, et cetera, but we got a pretty cool team of people. But I do like to wear a lot of hats, so I have this funky title, Head of Special Initiatives, and I work on a lot of stuff. I've built and bought data centers and connectivity and transit. I was one of the founding members of the Google Talk team. And about 8 months ago, I got this inkling of an idea that I wanted to build a Wi-Fi network. So I head up the Wi-Fi stuff, in addition to a lot of other random stuff. So I wanted to talk to you about kind of Google and our Wi-Fi stuff, but particularly in the context of the theme of this conference. So there's obviously at one end the net neutrality themes and the kind of the erudite policy discussion. On the other hand, there's just what can we do to get more access to more people cheaply and more accessible. So I think you're very familiar with Google and who we are. We're big. We're in a lot of places now. We handle a lot of search traffic. I think for me, it's always fun to think about the very humble beginnings. Literally, Larry and Sergey didn't start in a garage. They graduated to a garage. They started in a dorm room. I know some of you in here are friends of them and were friends of them then. And they actually had to leave the dorm room because the servers got too hot. They couldn't sleep in there anymore. So they graduated to a garage. Some of the original computers for Google actually came from the loading docks at Stanford, where Larry and Sergey would lurk and offer to configure computers for any professors who needed them configured, and it would be a 2 to 3 month process until new ones came in. And yes, and the lower right-hand corner is a server case that they actually built out of Legos. So very kind of early, humble, nerdy beginnings. And so I think it's fun to think about how we came from such a nerdy, scalable, data-driven company to a company that is hanging radios on lampposts in Mountain View, California right now. And so I think a cool way to kind of frame this is by thinking about something Esther Dyson just said in the paper the other day, as she read about Google's new presence in Washington and weighing in on the net neutrality debate. She said, it's sad. These guys are having to grow up now, dealing with grown-up issues. Well, Esther's a good friend of mine, and I agree with her that we're having to grow up a little bit, but I don't think we've grown up that far yet. In fact, I think that instead of thinking about us like grown-ups, it's best to think about us as punky, geeky skateboard teens, I think. Because I think in the end, when we build products, we kind of build them the way a skate punky kid would. So, which is with no constraints. Well, really, when we build new products and we take on new projects, we try and do so without really having to bind ourselves to the limitations of reality. And so that ranges everywhere from technical stuff like CPU power and bandwidth and storage all the way down to, and it's fascinating, we are expressly allowed to piss off our partners when building new products. And we're told by Eric, Larry, and Sergey to not take into account the ramifications, particularly if what you're doing in the end is in the best interest of the end user and you're really solving a problem for end users. If you're doing that, it's widely encouraged. And so what's fun is we get to do some very disruptive things. Now, I think it's best to take this all in the context of our mission statement, which is to organize all the world's information, make it universally accessible and useful. By all the world's information, we mean all of it. And I think it's interesting that we found that when you start filtering information yourselves and start trying to collect which information you should gather and which you shouldn't, you end up missing some nuggets. This is a picture that's taken with a camera that has a gigapixel of resolution, so 1,000 megapixels. And if I zoom in on it digitally, so it's from the same vantage point optically, but I zoom in on it digitally, what we find is that there was information in that picture that we didn't even know was there in the first place, and that we only gathered by going out and trying to get all the world's information. So,
broccoli.
Yeah, if I keep going, you're right. So there's a lot of information out there, though. We estimate there's about 5 million terabytes, and so far we've collected about 170. So we've got a little ways to go still, and we're diligently working on it and buying more disks, et cetera. But that said, once you have this scope of all the world's information, how do you decide what to actually build? And we are constantly at Google working on a variety of projects. Last I checked in the project database, there's about 1,950 projects pending right now at Google. And so, any engineer can start a project. You're required to spend 20% of your time working on something other than your core job. So we're constantly picking new things to work on. But there's one common characteristic that underlies every new project we take on, And that's the user experience. User experience drives everything we do. And I think this is in sharp contrast to the way some of our competitors do business. As we like to say it, they find their existing cash cows and they milk them. And they, so they try and take an existing business and push out and extend that to end users. Whereas I think we start with the end user experience and work backwards, and maybe we'll luck into a business. I mean, as Eric and Larry and Sergey say frequently, that if you build something with a loyal user following, the revenue will come eventually. So for us, we focus a lot on what users want. They want to search and find stuff. We all in this room use Google or other search engines every day. We want to find the answers we're looking for. We want to do business on the web. We want to share, collaborate, pictures, blogging, that kind of stuff. But I think what's most relevant to this audience is global access. By global access, we mean access to all different kinds of data platforms all the time, wherever you are, across a multitude of devices, without a bunch of passwords, without a bunch of proprietary standards to navigate, just plug and play, ease, simplicity. You know, as I think about what I'd like to see in the future of global access and networking, I'd like to see a bunch of little nets, a bunch of little networks that are all interconnected, and they interoperate and they bring connectivity to everyone all the time. But somebody's got to build those networks. And the truth is, it's probably not going to be Google. I'd also like to see more devices out there. I think for years and years, it's been a small number of devices that has served all of us, and we've had to share access on those devices. But now the technology is there for more and more devices to serve people, particularly in kind of devices that are accessible at the same time, concurrently. And it won't just be one device or the other, but concurrent use of devices. But somebody's got to build those devices and make them interoperable. And so I see the vision of what we'd like to have happen. We'd like to have connectivity everywhere, all the time, across a bunch of devices. And then we think about, so what's Google going to do to help this? We're still a very young company, and we realize that to be a great device manufacturer, you need to have chops that we don't. And to be a great worldwide network operator, you need to have chops that we don't. And I think that no one company can actually solve this problem. It's going to require the efforts of dozens and dozens of companies, literally. But that said, we want to do what we can to kickstart this, because I want to see more networks out there. I want to see more competition. I want to see greater ease of use. I want to see lower prices. I want to see the connectivity dream that we all have. And I also want to see cooler devices. Right now, the devices are still a challenge. And so I want to see more device manufacturers making things that translate from one network to the next and that take you from inside to outside and across and maintain your same network profile and your same user information from one device to the next. So we at Google have tried to think about what can we do to jumpstart some of this. So though we're young, we know we're good at a couple things. One of them is we're good at building applications that people like. And in this context, we think that if we build location-based applications that people like, we will go ahead and create demand for networks that can provide location information. So one of our first forays into this is a program called Google Local Mobile that's available for your cell phone or BlackBerry. It's basically anything that doesn't run Brew or Palm. So this is a program that's very location-based, even though it doesn't have access to location data. As you know, carriers lock up that data, and so we have not been able to successfully convince a carrier to allow users to opt into providing location data to these programs. That said, it's a very location-oriented program. It has local search on it. You can search for sushi in a zip code. You can get directions. That was how my cabbie found her way here today from the airport. It's a very cool program, and we think that by building programs like this, we'll actually create demand that may unlock some of this information from the carriers. But something else we know we're good at, making money for network operators. So our search and our ads generate tens to hundreds of millions of dollars for our networking partners every year. And we think that if we can take that revenue-generating channel and go ahead and enhance it by introducing location information into that. So now you've got advertising that's specific to a couple of block radius. Now you've got dry cleaners who want to advertise and local businesses and restaurants. We think that we can create an even more robust monetization channel that's going to incent people to build these networks. So we, in turn, can hand somebody the keys to a business, and they can build networks like this. So imagine, if you will, Google Local right now, which is our local search. Here you're looking for a hotel in New York City. You already see an opportunity to monetize that. But if we're able to auto-populate the location so you just search for a hotel and it already knew where you were or where you were going, then I think we would have a great opportunity to monetize there. And network operators would be able to make some pretty nice money. So the third thing we know we're pretty good at is opening our mouths and convincing others. So Sometimes this is very direct. This is not an area where I specifically specialize, but we have our own guys who work on this, who are much smarter than I am. One of them, Alan Davidson, is with us here today. He's one of our policy gurus working on issues related to net neutrality and the internet generally. And Andrew McLaughlin, who I'm sure some of you know, who's working on a lot of these issues globally. So these guys are there starting the conversation across the industry. I mean, it's fascinating to see us collaborating with guys like Microsoft and Yahoo and IAC and Amazon and guys like that. So I think we are trying to be as vocal as possible. Same time, we've got Vint Cerf writing on the Google blog and testifying before Congress about the impacts of regulation in this area. So all that said, this is a little bit out of my comfort zone. I'm not much of a policy wonk, but I know how to do one thing, which is actually just start building stuff. And when I looked at how I could try and accelerate the curve in this space and how Google generally could move things ahead, we got pretty excited to try and build a free network. So I want to tell you a little bit about the free network we're building in Mountain View, California, and how we're trying to inspire more of these networks worldwide. So this will be a diagram familiar to anyone who's ever looked at Tropos equipment, because this is Ron Sege's diagram, actually. But I think it's a good one to explain how a wireless network made with Tropos mesh nodes actually has multiple tiers. So there's the client tier, the laptops, they can go in police cars, they can go in dual-mode Wi-Fi phones, Sony PSPs can interact with the network like this. But you have these Wi-Fi nodes that are hanging on lampposts. They interact with a gateway layer, a capacity injection layer, and a backhaul layer that ultimately consolidates all the bandwidth in one place and you move it out to the internet. In the case of our network, we're using mesh, and mesh is great because you actually don't have to provide backhaul to each of the lampposts. Basically, the radios hang on lampposts, and they talk to each other, and you only need a specific, a smaller number of injection points. And if one of those fails, the network automatically fails over and routes the traffic through the rest of the mesh. It's really fun. You know, we're at a phase now in our build-out where we've not only seen this academically, but we're starting to see it as we've started testing the network. The network's up for trusted testers, and we'll be launching soon in a couple of months to the entire city. So we have a full end-to-end subscriber management system that's been interesting. And what we think is really fun about that is it puts us in a position to really understand the demands that an operator claims that they have to satisfy when they walk into hearings like this. So we're both an advocate of net neutrality, and now we're going to be a network operator. And so I think it's going to enhance our credibility as we think about our story in this space. But a couple more pictures. This is what the radios look like when they're actually hung on the lampposts. And those are gateway units that extend up the lamppost. This is a map of where all the radios are. So Mountain View is 11.5 square miles. We're using about 330 radios for access here. Ultimately, these are going to provide a service of about 1 megabit per second free of charge to end users citywide. We're not going to cap usage. We're going to just see what the network can do. All that a user will have to do is come to a splash screen. It's kind of a captive portal, and just register for free for username and password, and they can actually turn off that registration once they're inside the network. So it's we are trying to leave the last mile of the network actually insecure or unsecure intentionally so that we can encourage the broadest range of devices to connect to the network. We think that if you go with 802.1x, you actually are cutting out a lot of neat connectivity devices that haven't actually caught up yet in terms of the supplicant. And so we're encouraging folks to either use, we've built a VPN client that people can use, or they can bring their own VPN client. But at the end of the day, we want to encourage the widest range of devices to come and experiment on this network. And it's been fun. We've had guys from the gaming companies like Sony and Nintendo reach out to us. We've had folks from Siemens and Motorola come and bring us dual mode phones. You know, all these skunkwork projects that they never want the carriers to know they actually exist are starting to come and play on our network a little bit. So here's just a quick map of the three subscriber gateway bandwidth kind of aggregation points that we have. So at the top of the map is our headquarters building, where we have a mast up on top of the building that's collecting bandwidth. In the middle of the map is 444 Castro, the tallest building in Mountain View. And then at the bottom is St. Francis High School, where we've put a radio on top of the football stadium lights to go ahead and aggregate the bandwidth. Ultimately, it makes it all the way back to the Google headquarters by point to point, and we send it out to the internet by redundant paths there. In building the Mountain View network, I've opted for the most simple model possible just to try and get it up and working. So there aren't many bells and whistles. The start page is very boring. We're just trying to get it working, just trying to get you some throughput. We're fans of open access, though. In San Francisco, we have bid as a subcontractor, basically an anchor tenant of an Earthlink network, where we'll be an anchor tenant who pays Earthlink in order to provide a free service to folks. And that is being proposed as an open access model, where basically anyone who's willing to pay some reasonable wholesale price will be able to provide service there. Again, I have not built that into Mountain View just because it's tricky enough for me to try and be an ISP, let alone a wholesale ISP at the same time. There's a whole other set of tools I have to build. And since I'm not going to be doing this permanently, I didn't want to invest in doing that. But that said, open access generally in terms of tools and equipment is a big thing for us. I mean, Ron Segui, the head of Tropos, will attest to, you know, we've pushed on those guys and they favorably responded to making their devices interoperate, for instance, with more CPEs, consumer premises equipment, right? So Wi-Fi mesh does pretty well inside the front room of the house, and then to get through the rest of the house, you probably need some equipment to pick it up and really relay that. And so we've been working with those guys to try and extend the number of devices that would interoperate with a Tropos mesh. I do think there's some IP you need in the middle of the mesh. I don't think you can completely do it with standalone devices. And I also think there's a math problem there where small, low-powered access points aren't really going to achieve the kind of coverage that you can get with these 1-watt radios. So I don't think you're going to get to a totally utopian kind of everyone puts an access point in their house and it works model. But I think there's a hybrid there where people are going to have open devices that extend a mesh network like that. And that's important to us. So it's a pretty fun network. But like I said, it's given us an opportunity to understand what it's like to be a carrier. And so what we've decided to do is put our money where our mouth is here and kind of make a proclamation that we are going to treat packets with all respect and rights. And so and we think that in doing so that we're kind of realizing the intent that the founders would have had. I don't know if you can see that, but it appears that if you zoom in, they had some Nintendo DS devices with embedded Wi-Fi. But we really like to have a lot of dialogue with people. And I think even in this room, I've met with people who've found me through my blog and have sent me email over the years. So I'd really like to hear your impressions. I mean, ultimately, I'd like to see this network in Mountain View succeed, and I like to see it as an inspiration for networks around the world. So we hope that we've touched something off and that ultimately our applications and our monetization channels will really help more of these networks exist.
We just heard Chris Sacca explain how Google used the internet's openness to explore what it's like to be a carrier. But the internet's openness is not a foregone conclusion. We'll be back in a minute with more voices from Freedom to Connect. This is David Eisenberg of the Berkman Center with voices from Freedom to Connect. I know of no other instance prior to Freedom to Connect when both former FCC Chairman Michael K. Powell and former FCC Chairman Reed Hundt have appeared at the same conference. Next, we'll hear from both of them discussing the four principles of network neutrality that Representative Boucher spoke about earlier. First, we'll hear from Michael Powell, who was chairman of the FCC from 2001 to 2005, when the four internet freedoms were first introduced.
You know, I was one of the early public officials who stood up and talked about net neutrality. I called it net freedoms at the time. and still subscribe to it wholeheartedly. But I'm also a student of Washington and regulatory process, and I'm worried for what's going on. The gospel of open internet and edge innovation seems to me to have great merit, but I am very worried about putting your faith in the governmental oversight process to guarantee it for you. We're playing it, you know, this community, in my mind, is playing a potentially dangerous game for a couple reasons, and I'm just going to spit them out and we can move on. But number one, the legislative process does not work well when it has a very weak understanding about innovation and technology. And you were talking about 536 members who've got to get this, or at least 60% or 51% of them. I can probably count on my two hands who I think those might be. So I think they have a very shallow current understanding of tech. If you go give a quiz about the seven layers of the internet, good luck. So be careful of inviting the legislative process when they have a very bad understanding of the technical underpinnings, because the secondary consequences of their errors can be enormous. Number two, I think be careful. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. I'm a big believer in subversion or jujitsu when it comes to this stuff, which is let the weight of inertia be on your side, which is mean I would rather try to constantly position my industry where I succeed if government does nothing, versus positioning it in a way where I need them to do something or I'm dead. Because if you're in a position you desperately need them to do something or you're dead, start ordering your coffin and digging the plot, because this process is cumbersome, slow, and deliberative. And the other thing is, you can believe in a snapshot of time, you can trust the government, by the way, who will have a vague definition because they don't get it well enough. If this community doesn't understand it, as I heard, I can tell you right now, very few people in Washington do, which means you're going to get a potentially very ambiguous, subject to massive variations in interpretation kind of law. Now, personalities change, political power changes, congressmen come and go, presidents change. You're living with sort of this perpetual cycle of interpretation. And by the way, it's always easier to get a law on the books than to ever get it off again. If it goes on, be prepared that it's there for 15 to 20 years. And the other thing is, I think government has a way of turning on people, which is, ask Bill Gates, which is, it may be about networks today, but those same principles can be used against innovative business models and applications in another context. And I submit to you, they would be. They would be. It might have to do with interoperability of your new product with somebody else's product. It may have to do with servers and caching. Someone will think it's a good idea to apply the same basic principles to the other side of the community. Third and lastly, for the moment, I would say, be careful because you're playing their game. Regulatory battles are an art form, and these guys are the maestros. It's always a little like Brer Rabbit. Oh, woe is me, throw me on the briar patch and regulate me. Well, the average one of these incumbents, whether they're cable or phone company, you have 40 lawyers in Washington dedicated to this work. Resources, ability, 100 years of skill. Not criticizing, only saying the reality. And then I meet entrepreneurs who have 12 guys and can't afford a legal cost center, research. And then let me add the judicial process. Every decision you get from the Congress to the FCC, we'll spend the next 3.5 to 4 years in court.
The FCC before Powell was much more regulation-oriented. During Chairman Reed Hunt's tenure, the Telecom Act of 1996 was being negotiated, passed by Congress, and implemented by the FCC. It is not surprising that Reed Hunt's view of the four principles conflicts dramatically with Powell's.
I greatly admire what Mike did to fight for these four principles at the FCC, but they are a palsied, weak, pale shadow compared to rules. They are not in substance addressing the issues. They do not provide guides. They do not provide signs. They do not lay out a program. And they are issued in the context of the House subcommittee saying that the FCC shall never have any rules at all. It will only decide things on a case-by-case basis. Case-by-case means this. It means all decisions are about something that occurred 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. They always mean that with the expenditure of lots of money on lawyers and appeals, any particular company can avoid an adjudication till long after the issue is relevant from a business perspective. Case-by-case adjudication does not affect capital expenditure planning, does not affect strategy, does not affect the way that networks are built. It is simply a rear-view mirror look at what did happen, as opposed to a through-the-windshield look at what should happen. To say to the FCC, you can't have inquiry and you can't have rules, is the same thing as saying that the United States will have no plan. Well, we already decided in the last few years that we would have no broadband subsidy plan. We're the only country in the world that doesn't think broadband ought to be everywhere and for everyone, and where cost is an issue, we ought to find a way to subsidize. The only country in the world that takes that view. Does this mean that we are somehow or other more efficient in terms of profits? Absolutely, I already said that. In terms of reaching everyone and wrapping the whole country in a web of intelligence and creating one social fabric that can, in fact, be, among other things, a very low-cost distribution mechanism for dot-coms, in that respect, we are completely and totally to be deemed a failure. We are not committed, in my judgment, to creating a high and rising standard of living with the single most important tool for doing so, which is the web. And this is the discussion that we're not even having. These principles, access, everyone should have access. The upstream access isn't discussed. It isn't even part of the discussion. It's incredibly important. There's no discussion of price, no discussion of quality, no discussion of mobile access, not even mentioned. People should, say, principle number two, be able to use any applications. Yes, but the protocols need to be open. There can't be proprietary APIs. You have to have a paradigm where it's possible for an entrepreneur or a big company to design to some known set of protocols, not discussed in these principles. People should be able to connect any physical hardware. Well, yes, but more important, all networks should be able to connect at almost no price. There's nothing about interconnection policy here, but everybody knew in the 90s that the internet was a network of networks. And competition, we should be in favor of competition, says the last of the principles. Would that be two firm competition or one firm competition? What are we talking about here? It makes all the difference in the world to have 5, 6, 7 competitors and ease of entry for anyone. Let one win if there's going to be a winner-take-all system, and let it always be that they won after something equivalent to March Madness. And there was always a new 64-team tournament right around the corner as the next innovation cycle hit. Those are real. That's what a real set of rules would look like. It would discuss these issues in a core manner. It's a valiant fight by very few people at the FCC even to attach these vague principles as sort of conditions to mergers. But it is a sad day in our country when the Congress would pass a law that says you couldn't even have that discussion at the FCC or anywhere else, or anywhere else.
Is the internet a private mall or a public space? Should it be governed by economic forces or the rules of a democratic society? Again, the two chairmen, Powell and Hunt, have very different views.
I think the conception of it as a public place is the right metaphor, at least sort of uber metaphor to sort of guide your deliberations. But we also have to be sort of pragmatic and realistic about the way things really work. And by the way, some of this nobody has any discretion to change. For example, an infrastructure owner does have property rights and even has a Fifth Amendment in the Constitution that protects them at some level. For example, the government, no matter what assertion of public good, would probably find itself in unconstitutional territory if it suddenly swooped in and tried to nationalize infrastructure. All right, so the metaphor is useful, but of course, if you're going to be a realist, you're going to have to live with the realities of certain components that are going to have property and private interest pieces attached to it. The second thing I would say is, you know, look, as long as it's a capitalist society, and I also believe this is true for the engine that drives innovation, entrepreneurs want to get paid. And I don't mean very many entrepreneurs who are just in it to make a social statement. A lot of them are in it to create a product that's compelling and to sell it and be able to secure enough ownership and rights in that to profit from the risks they took. And I think that as long as you need one of the drivers of investment and innovation to be private gain, it's too facile to say, oh, somehow everything belongs to the American public. My friend and advisor, Chris Lebertelli, is sitting here. I'm sure Nicholas Zennstrom is not of the mind that at the end of the day, Skype should just belong to the public. or anyone else who's creating something of value. And why should it, by the way? You invented it. And I think part of your motivation to invent it is to be rewarded for it. And so as long as there's going to be a mechanism of a producer chasing value for consumers in exchange for compensation or profit, you know, it is inherently a private sector system that has a major driver to be sort of chasing innovation. And then the last thing I would say is what I'm worried about sometimes for those who are most married to the metaphor of the public space, they run into a little trouble when they start trying to figure out who's supposed to pay for everything. And there's often a quick, kind of convenient answer, well, the government should. Ladies and gentlemen, our government's not paying for any of this stuff. It's broke. It's going to stay broke for a really long time. The Tennessee Valley project for broadband is not coming. And I don't ever like to debate this one, even philosophically. I don't care about whether you believe they should or they shouldn't. I'm just telling you what's going to happen. And it's not coming. So if it's not coming, that means if we don't like 16th in the country in broadband and we want 100 megabyte infrastructure and not 1.5 DSL, you know, then you're going to have to be cognizant of, we have to generate models that continue to force private capital to flow into that desire, because I just don't think the cavalry is coming from the public sector to fund that stuff.
Former FCC Chairman Reed Hundt.
First of all, the government ought to create a public thoroughfare to the internet by regulation. Yes, just like in France, just like in Japan, just like in Korea. That public thoroughfare ought to be fast. I care less about how fast upstream and downstream it is on day one, and much more about the following, which is every year it ought to be faster. The technology permits it. That ought to be the rule. The public thoroughfare ought to be constantly improved, just like roads, just like the airline industry, just like all transportation systems in a country that has the national economic policy of improving everybody's standard of living and have it continually go up. That's point number one. If that means that a telephone company ought to get $1,000 per household in order to put fiber in the ground and they want the money from the taxpayers, that is less than a tenth of the amount of money that's been budgeted over the next decade for the anti-missile defense system that doesn't work. You can't make these comparisons up. This is the truth. You can't make this up. You can't believe it. We have committed in Iraq more than $1 billion. And we're talking here about basing our information economy on expenditure, $1 trillion, sorry. And we're talking about basing our information economy on a subsidy which, according to the calculations I've done, to split the difference between willingness to pay an actual cost, not total cost, but the difference between willingness to pay an actual cost, it's maybe $20 billion, would be the necessary subsidy for fiber to the home for everyone. If you had that, it would be, technologically speaking, the work of but a moment to allocate some of it to a public thoroughfare. I would write the check, $20 billion, to the lowest cost provider that wanted to give me that fiber to the home in a heartbeat, let them have half of it for their VPN, the other half for the public thoroughfare. It's over. It's done. If it were one public thoroughfare, that's just fine. I really don't need more than one I-95. One is enough of a problem. But we ought to have a commitment to at least one. This astonishing regulatory idea isn't even voiced in Washington today. Point number two, this public thoroughfare ought to be for everyone, everyone, everywhere, all the time, in every way, meaning up and down, meaning through all patchworks of networks, for everyone, all the time, everywhere. It ought to be everyone in the country. It ought to be ubiquitous, which means it has to be wireless end wire. To say that in Washington today is to be left-wing, is to be thought to be crazy. It only happens to be the dominant paradigm in every developed and developing country in the world. This is the only country in the world where it can't even be said. Lastly, the most important thing about the public thoroughfare is that it gets us to a public space, and that space is the web. There are many things that Gigi and others are showing tremendous leadership about in terms of debating and articulating the fundamental precepts behind making sure that in that public space there is the right to be creative and that which ought to be public and generated out of a desire to be creative doesn't become subjected to a variety of proprietary claims. I honor all that. I only want to make one point. In this public space to which the public thoroughfare must take us, it is in that space that democracy in the United States will be defined. It is in that space that we will learn to debate issues and find out truth and form groups, and we won't agree with each other. And we will find in that space the way to debate with each other. It is in that space in China that will be determined the future of human rights versus totalitarianism. It is in that space, eventually, in the war-torn Middle East, that there will be that same debate between individual liberty and human rights and those that would deny it in the name of ideology. It is in that space on a global level all around the world that humanity will find expression. That space in the United States cannot be jeopardized by the lack of public thoroughfare.
We've heard from Rick Boucher on the next Telecom Act. We've heard from Google about how the next law could advance or threaten innovation. And we've heard from two former FCC chairmen with markedly different views of what's best for the internet and indeed what's best for America. How should we balance innovation, creativity, free speech, and democratic participation? Which of these do we value most highly? The answers to these questions will guide the future of the internet, and perhaps the future of America. Four Voices from Freedom to Connect was produced by David Eisenberg and Colin Rhinesmith, with music by Joe Craven. Brought to you by Audio Berkman, a production of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School.